Alan Argyle is one of the most trusted names in crisis communications and reputation management. He's advised on over 400 real-life corporate crises, authored policies for Fortune 100s and governments, and delivered over 1,500 executive media training sessions. He's worked with everyone from global giants to lean startups. And if you haven't seen one of Alan's presentations or training sessions in action, your bucket list has another item to add. You'll be missing out on one of the quiet thrills of the communications world, so I would certainly suggest getting an invite if you can. He's also presented this show many times before, so in what's becoming a feature of Aprio Voice, we're once again turning the mic around and putting him in the hot seat for a change. Alan, welcome. Brilliant to have you.
Thanks, and thanks for that very kind introduction, Tom.
Let's set the scene, Alan. What is storytelling as it relates to the corporate and brand-centric world that we find ourselves in today?
Yeah, look, not getting into dictionary definitions, but for me, I think it's the art and it's also the science, the two go together, of communicating information, ideas, motivating, inspiring, reassuring, providing context, but through compelling, authentic narratives, metaphors, anecdotes, rather than simply listing facts to your audience in order to engage with that audience and ultimately to build trust. It's about engineering trust through metaphors, stories, rather than data or through executive appeals. You know, we committed to this, we are leading that. I think those are rather, or can sometimes be empty and vacuous versus an authentic story.
And what would you say first drew you into exploring storytelling as part of your work? Was it a natural fit for your personality, or did you find that it was something you grew into over time?
Sure. Might need to put me onto the therapist's couch. Perhaps an insecurity of not ever wanting to be boring. You know, I think we've all sat through lectures or classes or corporate presentations of the proverbial death by PowerPoint or through 3-minute introductions and protocols. So looking, I suppose, to try and, yeah, really influence through a more compelling way of engaging with an audience and through university, through corporate life, through consulting, always been a desire to certainly to hook an older audience, to try and ensure that after 30 seconds, they don't go, what have we put ourselves in for today? And are rather inspired to stick around to see what's coming.
Having known you for a while now, and maybe this is getting back onto the therapist's couch, but you're certainly not someone who seeks a spotlight, but you do have an amazing ability to command a room. Just to your point around sort of, you know, death by PowerPoint, I certainly wouldn't associate you with anything like that. What role do you think quiet confidence plays in storytelling?
I think it certainly plays a big role. I mean, everyone's got a different tonality to their storytelling voice. For me, I think that confidence has come out through experience, through having told sometimes, quite frankly, the same story to open a presentation hundreds, if not thousands of times, and understanding how it lands with that audience and when perhaps not to use it because it's going to bomb on you. So that quiet confidence that comes from having been in the situation many, many times, understanding how it's likely to play out. And perhaps the biggest challenge then is telling a story, and to be frank, one that you've perhaps told 600 times, but telling it like it's the first time you're sharing it with that particular audience. That's possibly the big challenge. And yeah, that confidence that comes from, I've seen this work before, and if we can land this well, it's going to set us up for the next 2, 3, sometimes 4 hours worth of working with this particular group.
Lovely. Sort of authenticity in the moment. As I mentioned up front, you've advised on over 300 crisis situations. Incredibly impressive. Is there a place for storytelling in crisis management or crisis mitigation at all?
Certainly, I can't remember a specific crisis where I've advised or have used storytelling to counter perhaps the narrative of the other side. Often it's story that puts an organization into crisis. It's the activist story about that particular toxic environment that companies accused of or implicated in. It's about the story of the disgruntled former employee who's accusing the company of toxic workplace practices or racism, sexual harassment. It's a community who feel aggrieved about the actions of a particular large mining group, for example. So it's the other side stories that I think shape the agenda to a very large extent. And I'd be very wary of trying to mitigate the impact of their stories with your own stories as the counterparty. You know, we all know what it's like if you share your deep concern, your domestic circumstances with your manager, and they say to you, wow, you think you've got it bad. Look where I'm having to engage with every day. Look what I'm facing. So to try and out-Trump, and I think that's a particularly perhaps inappropriate use of phrase these days, but to try and sort of counter a grievance story or a concern story with your own story as an organization in a crisis typically won't land well. Where I have often seen it used and do so myself is sometimes contextualizing this crisis situation for your employees, for clients, to say, you know, to no way undermine the severity or the significance of it, but to perhaps provide some perspective. You know, in our 150-year life as a corporate, we have been through many of these in the past. We're taking some valuable lessons out of this, but we will come through these tailwinds. We will come through this to the other side. So telling stories about how you've perhaps grappled with similar obstacles in the past can sometimes be a very helpful reassurance device, contextual device, but I'm not sure about addressing, trying to mitigate the protagonist story with your own stories in the middle of a crisis situation, whether that would ever be appropriate.
I mean, just speaking on, you know, a little more on essentially getting your story across, whether a brand or an individual or an executive in a company, a board member, perhaps, how do you create messages today that essentially cut through in this age of distraction and distrust?
Sure. You know, it's perhaps a hackneyed word these days, but authenticity, sincerity, you know, recognizing the counterparty story, acknowledging it, recognizing the perceived validity of it, very, very important. But sometimes you just really need to hold back perhaps from really sharing the kind of messages that you believe need to be heard for this particular day. Perhaps they are best shared and heard in a week's time, in a month's time, once the storm has subsided in some ways. And perhaps your messaging is more about apology, acknowledgement, what we're doing to resolve, what we're doing to redress, what are we looking to provide restitution in these situations, rather than necessarily a kind of a classic counter story or why we believe in the merits of our side of things and trying to play down the merits of the counterparty in this particular issue or crisis scenario. Authenticity, sincerity, knowing when to wait and when to speak, very, very important in any scenario, I would submit.
So you mentioned Trump. You went there. Let's go there. We're living through political chaos, especially in the US. Figures like Trump dominate global narratives on a daily basis. And like him or not, he's a master of commanding the plot. And when he's on the telly, it definitely makes it very difficult to look away. How would you say organizations should respond when individual characters, you know, whether they're sort of anti-heroes or villains, if you like, grab the spotlight?
Sure. You know, I think chapter 6 or element 6 in my 12-element media training has got a headline, you know, be professional and be presidential. And I've had to provide context to that of late because our sort of classic interpretation of what being presidential is has perhaps been severely and significantly disrupted by certain leaders around the globe. So I think there's a different set of conduct and behaviors that corporate leaders have to apply, have to align with, versus perhaps their political counterparts. I'm grappling with perhaps a little essay at the moment about how, you know, one can't as corporate leaders use the President Trump playbook, because you won't survive, I believe, as a corporate leader by using the kind of techniques and the disingenuous type of conduct that perhaps comes out of the White House. Perhaps this is going to get heavily edited thereafter. But in terms of, you know, how we see it play out, everybody's a broadcaster these days. So you get a disgruntled former employee or current employee or client going onto social, publicizing their agenda, their narrative, their story in ways that are borderline defamatory, certainly very toxic. And how does one respond to that? And they're getting affirmed by their tribe in those networks, in terms of, and I use tribe in a very generic sense, you know, their followers, their fans. So to insert yourself into those situations and to say there is a different story, here is the full picture, very, very difficult. Certainly, I believe in mainstream media and in social to counter their sometimes very toxic and borderline, as I said, defamatory, libelous type of accusations in those media. Where I'm often advising is you've got to go directly then to your own tribes, to your colleagues, to your clients, to your investors, and give them a counter narrative. As you might be aware, there is this kind of conversation or these kind of allegations are being made. We want to give you the full picture, to give you that reassurance. So to position your story with the stakeholders you count, whose trust is so, so vital for your future business continuity and growth, rather than taking it into the broadcast platforms, whether it's social or mainstream media, you're just going to get hammered. No degree of rationalism or a true story for whatever that might look like is going to be countenanced by the fanboys of or girls of that particular critic in social. You're going to just take a hiding to nothing. Rather try and contextualize, reassure by reaching out directly to the stakeholders you can't in your network, in your universe. Mm.
And back to that point that you raised earlier around authenticity and transparency, really, building those authentic relationships. Do you think people still trust brands, or is it only people? And how should that shift how we think about messaging in the broader context?
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast in the last couple of days around that trust deficit and living in a post-trust world, in a sense, and no degree of rational inputs will perhaps shift opinions that we've heard it from our leader that they say this is not the case, therefore it must be true. So I'm not sure. I mean, we see all these surveys and research every year around trust in mainstream media and trust in politicians, trust in faith-based leadership, trust in brands. I think it is just in a general state of decline. And you know, we hear stuff like fake news and fake media. And I'm not quite sure how brands navigate in this world of where everyone's a broadcaster, where people aren't questioning the narratives they hear from the commander-in-chief or that particular podcaster. It's just quietly plodding on, doing the right things and hoping that we're going to emerge from this fog at one stage or at some stage, and that quiet, authentic, sincere, honest, credible behaviors, stories are going to prevail. They're going to win through. But having a capacity for pain and a thick skin to deal with the counter narratives these days, very much a requirement. one of my family members said, you know, in the old days, the village idiot sort of was confined to the village because they had to get onto a donkey and travel for 4 days before they could share their views of the world. Now it's just, 30 seconds later and the village idiot is now the global idiot. So it is just, I don't know. I think I'm sometimes too old for this world, quite frankly, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's an interesting point. You know, a lot of the work that we do in digital is obviously about crafting stories and placing them in online platforms where people can access them. And there certainly is a cat and mouse. I mean, it's something we shouldn't shy away from. It's respect for your audience ultimately to have the right stories on the right platforms as well. But there's certainly the sort of cat and mouse effect where audiences will move to a social media platform or channel, and very soon after that, brands will follow and try to sort of authentically enter the conversation. And that's an ongoing question as to whether or not that's appropriate. Do people want that? Does it chase them off the channels they're currently on and onto new channels? So yeah, very valid, I think, everything you've said there in terms of the conversation around storytelling. And I think it is important to make sure we're having the stories on the right channels. Are there any moments in your storytelling career that have really stayed with you? Not because they were sort of dramatic news headline type pieces, but because they were deeply human.
Yeah, you know, Tom, in sort of doing a little bit of going back into my archives, because that's really in a way what it took, because I was doing a lot of leadership storytelling programs 15 years, 10 years ago. Quite frankly, I haven't done a lot of those in recent years. I don't know whether that's just a shift in leadership agendas, but going back in preparation for today's conversation with you and looking at some of the decks that I shared and spoke from 10, 15 years ago, looking, for example, at an image of Alan Kurdi, and that name won't be familiar with people, but I'm sure the image from 10 years ago still will be deeply, deeply moving, of a two-year-old infant washed up on a Turkish beach, his family amongst thousands of Syrians trying to flee the country on an overloaded little dinghy, and him, his mother, his brother, not making it, and that prone body captured by a photographer in a deeply human, sensitive way. But that image, you know, no narrative even accompanied it, changed the world, sadly all too briefly, but, you know, got people to revisit immigration policies, got aid organizations to get 15 times more donations in the month following that image. And so, yeah, in amongst this really volatile, unpredictable, disruptive post-truth world, there are moments where I believe a powerful image or a powerful story can just reset us as humans and remind us of our humanity. And I'm hopeful that whether it's around, you know, suspending investments in research in developing nations or suspending grants for universities, we will find stories, we will find images, we will find human connection that can turn all of this on its head and cut through legal arguments, cut through so much sort of disinformation out there. So the power of story to still change and to inspire and to influence, I still have quiet confidence that it has enormous power going forward.
Yeah, certainly that picture, you know, tells a story of 1,000 words is vital to remember. But you also touched on the importance of humanity and human connection. And I think it's very important to be cognizant of the fact that we do have another storyteller entering the picture. We have emerging tech in the form of artificial intelligence and large language models that are starting to drive and shape a lot more of our messaging, you know, whether we use them just in drafts at the moment or in looking at sentiment analysis and monitoring and spotting risks in the world of crises. AI can be hugely useful, but where do you think it helps? Where do you think it helps push the storytelling further, and where might it actually hinder it?
So as you're probably aware, I'm a little bit of a Luddite when it comes to some of this new tech and large language models or whatever terminology you used and AI bots. But I remember, well, probably 8 months ago, a client saying to me after a crisis workshop, and we're talking about playbooks and getting, you know, preparatory work in to perhaps help mitigate a range of crises. And he said, can't AI help with this? You know, we don't have budget to develop playbooks. And I remember saying, well, actually, I haven't really explored that. I don't know. And then going back that evening and typing in a crisis scenario and asking AI for a statement, and literally feeling a sort of kick to my solar plexus as something came back in seconds, and thinking some force, some arguably less than benign forces, somehow got access to my hard drive and literally accessed every statement I've written about that particular crisis scenario, synthesized them in microseconds, and played back my own hard drive to me. And it was just this revelatory kind of, wow, this is what AI can do. And I won't say it was perfect. There's no such thing. Sure. But it was certainly closer to perfection than I've seen many clients produce in crisis simulations when I've asked them to produce statements, etc. So that is AI in a crisis. And subsequently, you've used it to just provide very quick benchmarks around who the stakeholders, what considerations, what kind of statements, and then work off that. So in the last week, I've done that exercise from a storytelling perspective, and particularly from a leadership storytelling viewpoint, and typing in a brief. And I'm not saying it was a thoroughly comprehensive one. I think I write good briefs to AI, which hopefully helps with the kind of content I get back.
It does. Yeah.
But asked it to give me a story from a leader who's arriving new to a organization as a expat in an organization that's been through lots of leadership changes, experiencing financial challenges at the moment, lack of morale, and asking broadly, craft a story that's going to earn confidence of your executive peers at this company, that's going to inspire greater teamwork, reduce their suspicion of you as a foreigner, etc. Because one of the seven stories that I go through with leadership when I do a typical leadership storytelling is exactly one of those kind of stories. And I've got two or three real life stories from other new leaders that I share in those workshops. Put that into the sort of prompt and got back, quite frankly, a far better story than I expected, with all the right sort of outcomes, but with none of the color that typically would go into what I would see as a good story, none of the detail. Now, perhaps I didn't prompt it to give me the sight and the smells and the town that this guy and the grew up in and the machine that they all collectively worked on, compared to my bartending story, for example, where we talk about the drinks that he used to pour in Texas versus the drinks he poured in Chicago, where he discovered what made him great in one place didn't necessarily make him great in another. Mm-hmm. So a long way of saying, just really a very brief immersion. But what I'm seeing from my little sample of one is that AI isn't perhaps able to give that, just that human touch, the memory, the kind of stuff that's going to light up the brain of the audience in the same way it lights up the brain of the person telling that story. The sights, the smells, to transport people and say, I can relate, I can engage, I get it. I think that's where it perhaps might have weaknesses. It doesn't arguably have those weaknesses in a crisis scenario, but in a very inspiring, motivational, authentic kind of way, I think it's perhaps got a way to go. I'm probably going to be reminded that it can do this stuff very, very quickly, but currently that's where I might see a gap in its ability to deliver compelling human stories.
Yeah, and long may that last. I mean, I think if we look at the flip side of that, there's also this push towards humans discovering our humanity, which I think is a positive, and looking at those distinctly unique areas that do make us human, that do make connectivity important. So if AI is doing nothing but pushing us to be more human, that's probably not a bad thing. But certainly we must be aware of the risks, and, you know, over and above exactly what you've spoken about, this hallucination, you know, tendency towards bias, etc. A lot of work that still needs to be shifted out of the training data, as it were. But yeah, fascinating. Alan, it's been great chatting to you. I would love to just put two or three quick rapid-fire questions to you. So, one, give us one corporate comms cliche you'd love to retire forever.
Well, let's bring it back to crisis scenario. That's subjudice, so I can't comment on that right now. Yeah, it's limited to that one for now.
Great. Worst media training advice you've ever heard?
Speak for a long time in your response. That'll wind down the clock and limit the other questions that they might ask of you. Go 2 minutes, deliver a monologue, deliver a lecture whenever you're asked a question.
Best communicator you've ever seen in action?
Sure. There'd be a number. Likely to perhaps offend some clients by not mentioning them. Alan Pullinger, former head of R&B, then First Rand chief exec. I did a number of storytelling programs at R&B some years ago. And as part of the day, he'd come in and tell his leadership story for literally sort of 2 hours. And you'd think that's, I don't know, probably the length of Titanic, the movie. People didn't leave that room. And it wasn't because they shut the doors and bolted them closed. People were just hanging on every word of a quiet, authentic, non-showy, vulnerable chief exec sharing his leadership story for that amount of time. Riveting, compelling stuff. Shout out to Alan.
Amazing. Amazing. If you had to sum up your approach to storytelling in just one word, what would it be, Alan?
Let's get away from authenticity. Let's say vulnerability. I think that's such an asset to, yeah, to just share that you've been there when it's appropriate, not trying to compare, not to out-compete, but to tell your story first sometimes and make yourself vulnerable just opens the doors to all sorts of sincere change-making, trust-building behaviors and conversations going forward. Vulnerability.
Amazing. Alan, it's always a privilege chatting to you, and thank you so much for keeping us so completely engaged with all your storytelling work. I hope to chat to you soon.
Thanks, Tom. Been a pleasure sharing with you. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to Aprio Voice, a podcast from the reputation, management and strategic communications professionals at the Aprio Group. If you would like to find out more about the work we do, visit aprio.co.za.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.